The level of connection we have with one another now is unprecedented, but it's influencing something as old as civilization itself, and that's power. Today we talk with one of the authors of the new book, New Power, How Power Works in Our Hyper-Connected World and How to Make It Work for You, about how that hyper-connected world is changing the dynamics of control. We'll ask why some people and causes gain so much momentum while others are lost in the chaos of connectivity. The book is written by Jeremy Hymans and Henry Timms, and Jeremy joins us now from NPR Studios in New York. Jeremy, welcome. Nice to have you.
Steve, it's great to be here.
So your book is titled New Power. What do you mean by that, and who drives it, Jeremy?
Well, look, we see new power as essentially the kind of most crucial skill of the 21st century, and that is the skill of knowing how to harness the energy of a connected crowd in order to get the outcomes that you seek. And I think a really important point we make in the book is that, those outcomes can be good or bad, right? And but it's a critical form of power that is different to the traditional exercise of power, which was based on what we call old power, what you know or own and control that nobody else does.
Hmm. So what does this shift then begin to suggest about our changing values here?
Well, look, this is the extraordinary thing that we're seeing is we live in this world in which particularly younger people, but really all of us, our expectations around participating in every aspect of our lives have just shot up, right? We live in a world now where, when I grew up back in Australia, there were five television stations,
right.
There were some things, there were very limited ways that I could participate in the world. But, a teenager growing up today can potentially have millions of followers from her bedroom, that could be raising funds for their own projects, could be making products that they sell to a global market. So when those things happen, people's values change and they begin to expect a much bigger role in the institutions in their lives. And then when those institutions don't deliver, they can lose faith in those institutions.
Hmm. So this is an extraordinary moment you're describing here.
Well, I think that's right. And we're seeing it play out all over the world, right? From some of the dynamics that led to the election of Donald Trump to the Brexit decision in the UK. Mm-hmm. And of course, we're also seeing in business, right? We see a platform like Facebook, which is built on this ability to harness our participatory energies. And yet we see with Facebook that a lot of those energies are being extracted for Facebook's benefits rather than necessarily for ours.
So one of your points here is that you argue that individuals would rather feel this sense of ownership than to simply consume a product or idea. So given that, how is a platform like Wikipedia replaced a more traditional print encyclopedia?
Well, that's exactly right. And this is backed up by the behavioral economics research. There was a great experiment that was conducted a few years ago, and it produced what's called the IKEA effect. So they asked two groups of people to assemble furniture. So one group were asked to assemble the furniture from IKEA on their own, and the other were asked just had a professional assemble the furniture. So the professionals obviously assembled the furniture perfectly, and the amateurs, you and I, assembled the furniture rather unevenly. Of course, what then they asked the two groups to do is value their creations, value the furniture. And the people who'd produced worse furniture but that had been involved in creating that furniture valued their creations much more highly than the people who were simply given perfectly assembled furniture.
And your takeaway from that is what?
Well, the takeaway is that if you're, if you're in business, for example, and you're trying to get someone to buy in to a product, or if you're a politician and you're trying to get someone to buy into your ideas, you need to get people involved. So that key skill is figuring out how to harness all of that participatory energy and use it to pursue the goals that you have.
So that's the role of participation. I mean, you immediately think about a movement like, the Me Too movement that toppled the legacy of someone as central as Harvey Weinstein. And what a moment that was.
Well, that's right. And what a great example of this difference between old and new power. So you think of Harvey, you know, this is someone who thinks of power as a currency. You know, he hoarded that power.
Right.
He spent it to reward his friends, to punish his enemies, to protect himself over many decades. But you think about Me Too, and you can't treat the power that Me Too has created and the power, indeed, that toppled Harvey in the same way. You know, the Me Too movement doesn't have one person sitting at the top of a hierarchy. It has many leaders, and it surges across the world like a current. And it gets stronger as more people join it, and it also changes shape as it flows across geographies and across industries.
So this notion that once upon a time we were led by specific visible leaders like Malcolm X or Gloria Steinem, are those days over?
Well, yes and no. You know, leadership is still critical. But if you look at the Black Lives Matter movement as an example of a new form of social movement, you'll see the intentional choices that the founders of that movement made. They actually were deliberately trying to avoid the kind of speechifying preacher model of leadership that had been used in the civil rights era. And so there are three women who are the founders of Black Lives Matter. They're very expressly chosen not to play that kind of visible leadership on top of a hierarchy role. And rather, they've tried to make that movement spread sideways, make all of us potential owners of that movement. But they expressly don't think of this as a leaderless movement. They call it a leaderful movement. And that's actually a really important distinction.
Could this movement, anything like it, exist without social media? Probably not, right?
Well, I think that's the thing. The fact that we're all connected now means that our ideas can spread so much faster with so much more force, right? As we're seeing all around us, that can be a great thing when it's spreading important messages like the messages of the Black Lives Matter movement or Me Too.
Right.
And it can be a very destructive thing when it's about spreading misinformation.
You outline in the book the importance of new media to a campaign. Like, remember the Ice Bucket Challenge? It benefited ALS. Can you remind our listeners what happened there and talk about why that wound up being so darn successful?
Right. I mean, I think we probably all remember we couldn't quite avoid the Ice Bucket Challenge that summer a few years ago, and it was very effective. And, you know, really it was, again, because it wasn't just an idea where all you had to do was, you know, call in like the traditional telethon model and pledge money. You actually could participate, right? So the action was you got to make a video of yourself being dunked with, you know, with ice.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody kind of took that in their own direction, right? Mm-hmm. And then you would challenge a friend to do that, which kind of made it viral, because inherently in this idea that you challenge a friend at the end of each video, you're sort of passing along the idea. And then critically, everybody could give it their own spin, right? It was what we call extensible. So, you know, in India, the Ice Bucket Challenge was adapted and changed to become the Rice Bucket Challenge. And so you see how an idea like this just spreads. And that's the difference between the way ideas used to spread. In the 20th century, you could make a sound bite and then you would push that sound bite down to people and broadcast it. And now you really have to do something very different if you want your ideas to spread and have impact.
So, again, the key ingredients there, social media, participation, being able to put your own spin on the original idea put forward.
But that's right. And the critical thing to remember is it's not social media in and of itself. It's actually not about technology, because there are plenty of people, right, that are using technology and social media in very old power ways. You know, we like to say that the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad, you know, he too has a Facebook page, right? But this does not mean he's embraced the power of participation. So it's obviously not just about the tools you're using. It's about whether you're really pushing power down and out, or whether you're really just capturing power at the top and using social media the way you used to use a press release.
So the Ice Bucket Challenge was, in retrospect, pure genius, right?
Well, it was very cleverly designed. But it's important to note that not everybody can have an Ice Bucket Challenge, right? So if you look at something like that and you say, well, how do I get one of those for my project or my cause? It's less about counting on those freak deluges like the ice bucket challenge, and more about learning a new set of skills. And that's really what this book is about. We think this new set of skills about how you cultivate crowds, how you build movements, which we all need to do at the smallest scale and at the largest, how we spread ideas, how we think about leadership differently to the way we've all been brought up to think about it. These are critical skills that we all need, and it's not so much about having one big moment where we all have our 15 seconds of internet fame, and much more about a set of skills that we can learn alongside those old power skills that are important to us that we've grown up with and that continue to be very important.
Jeremy Hymans is our guest. He's co-author of a new book, New Power, How Power Works in Our Hyperconnected World and How to Make It Work for you. You know, Jeremy, I can't help but notice that we're talking about this on the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s death. And again, you can't help but notice that some of the biggest movements in recent years have centered around race. I'm wondering why.
Well, you know, I think what you see with movements and you see with new power is those things that create real intensity, real passion, are the things that spread, right? That's why it's hard to build movements, you know, around dry policy issues, right? That's why there hasn't been a passionate movement of Americans around infrastructure, even though infrastructure is a really important issue, right?
There's no passion behind it. Yeah.
There's no passion, right? Even though it's critical. So, you know, an issue like race strikes at the heart of identity and who we are. We all know people of different backgrounds, so we can immediately embody that in an individual, in the same way that the gay rights movement was hugely advanced by the fact that, you know, at a certain point, as more and more people came out, you know, most people in this country had a gay relative or had a gay friend, and that allowed them to really embody the issue. So race is obviously an issue that generates enormous intensity, again, in very positive ways, and as we've seen with the rise of white supremacy and the old right, in very dangerous ways. So the question, again, is who harnesses that intensity better? So on an issue like race, the big question of our times is it going to be the alt-right and their memes and their misinformation who are stirring up hate and trying to create this alternative identity around white nationalism?
Mm-hmm.
Or will it be the people trying to bring us together? Will it be the people who want to remedy those injustices?
And where would you put your money?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm an optimist on this, and I think that the trajectory in this country is going to ultimately bend toward a more inclusive society. But it will only happen if those of us who are on that side learn how to use these new power tools and learn how to do it more effectively than those who are trying to divide people.
New power and the tools that drive them. That's our topic here. Jeremy Hymans is my guest. If you want to join our conversation, we've got Jeremy just for a few more minutes. 816-235-2888 is our number here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You also deal with something less grand, I guess. Ride-sharing apps are another topic in the book. Tell us about how a company like Lyft has come to present, you know, a serious threat to Uber, and we now have both of those here in Kansas City, but for a while it was just Uber.
Right. Well, you know, we tell this really interesting story of the different ways that Uber and Lyft have managed their communities, right? Because ultimately, if you've got a whole bunch of drivers that are the lifeblood of your platform, you've got to figure out the way to build trust with them. And we say that the difference between Uber and Lyft, the Uber drivers are actually organizing pickets against Uber, whereas the Lyft drivers are organizing picnics where they're meeting each other. They're organizing around the goals of the platform.
And the difference is what?
Well, the difference is that Uber decided that it didn't trust its new power network. So, for example, Uber prohibited its drivers from communicating with each other, and it didn't provide a mechanism to do that. Whereas Lyft said, you know, we trust you and we want you to actually help us make the service better. So even though the business models are almost identical, they've got what we call, and what our colleague Arun at NYU has called, different platform cultures. And so if you're sitting astride any kind of online community, even if that's just a group of 500 or 1,000 people, who are your online community around your dental health practice, right? Mm-hmm. You need to learn how to cultivate and honor that base of people and really make them feel like they're part of the journey.
Well, and that leads me to another point in the book. This notion of transparency carries higher currency these days than confidentiality. That plays directly into the Lyft-Uber conversation. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, I think if you grow up in a world where there's just so much more transparency now in terms of the way people are living their lives, mm-hmm. particularly online, you know, norms around transparency change. So, you know, if you remember in 2016, one of the leaked speeches that Hillary Clinton gave, she says, look, you know, sometimes in politics, you need a public position and a private position that are a little different in order to sort of get things done, right? In order for the sausage to get made. And that's a very legitimate perspective. But unfortunately, in a new power world, it's just no longer realistic. And as Hillary Clinton herself experienced, you know, that transparency sort of blew up in her face with the WikiLeaks phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And so whether you like it or not, if you are an institution today, if you're a leader today, you sort of have to anticipate a world in which you will either be exposed to radical transparency or the people around you will demand it.
Well, does that then benefit President Trump, who I guess you could say is transparent in the sense that you sort of know what he's thinking a lot of the time because of what he puts up on Twitter?
I think it does help, right? It creates proximity between him and his supporters, right? His supporters feel like they are in a much closer relationship to him than they would if he'd elevated himself in the way that traditional presidents have done. And frankly, his shamelessness, in some ways with his base has been an asset because it's made it harder to criticize him because he doesn't play by those rules of decorum. And so people have kind of priced that in to Donald Trump.
It's interesting, you know, the election of one president typically in this country is a response to the previous president. President Obama, much more reserved, much more careful, perhaps, in his public remarks, maybe not as open in how he felt about a lot of the issues of the day. And here we have the response to that in a guy named Donald Trump.
Well, exactly. And, you know, in the book, we sort of tell this story of these two leaders, you know, Obama and Trump. And so what's so fascinating is, you know, Obama uses new power to get elected brilliantly, right? He has these millions of supporters. He raises hundreds of millions of dollars in crowdfunding. He has this incredible volunteer energy. And yet sort of once he's elected, I think one of the tragedies of the Obama presidency is that he didn't really succeed in bringing his movement into the presidency with him. And so he had a political movement to get elected, but not a governing movement. And so that meant that it was much harder for that movement to help elect his successor. And so what Donald Trump is doing is, you know, he clearly used new power to get elected, right? He had this vast decentralized social media army that was significantly more intense than Hillary's. Mm-hmm. But he's actually sort of taking that into office with him. He's sort of governing with that movement alongside him. And I think that is a strength that he has. And I think it underlies the need for, you know, those people who are trying to take on the president to really create movements, not just to get elected, but once they become a member of Congress, once they become a governor, how do you continue to build and engage that crowd and make them feel part of the project of governing?
This is fascinating. Jeremy Hyman's is my guest. His book, New Power, How Power Works in Our Hyperconnected World and How to Make It Work for You. Our phone number, again, just lost a call, 816-235-2888 here, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. In your book, you also argue that new power has utterly upended the ways we think about fundraising. Why is it that a Kickstarter page might be more successful than, say, the old-fashioned telethon?
Well, it is amazing how this has changed, right? Because, you know, in an old power world, if you wanted to raise money for something, you really needed the right connections, you needed to know the right people, you needed to know how to navigate usually a kind of complex application process for some government funding or some centralized pool of money. And now, of course, you need a different set of skills. You need this new power repertoire. And that's actually about getting much larger numbers of people excited about your project, but also getting them to really feel like they're part of it.
Part of a movement, yeah, right.
Right, part of a movement. They're sort of invested in what you're doing. And that requires something quite different. We tell this extraordinary story in the book of a video game called Star Citizen that is the largest crowdfunding campaign in history. It's raised more than $150 million. Mm. And yet the game still does not exist 4 years later.
What happened?
Well, you know, this is the fascinating thing. So, you know, everybody who contributed to the game started getting involved in making suggestions, in creating blogs and bulletin boards. And so there's this vast network of activity around the idea of this game, even though the game hasn't yet been delivered. And it's really remarkable because, you know, at one point someone in the community sort of piped up and said, well, listen, we all put money into this thing and it doesn't exist yet. And essentially that person was sort of shouted down by the rest of the community. And the way one of those Star Citizen backers described it is, I feel like I pay to dream.
That's a great line. Jeremy Hymans has been my guest. He's the co-author, along with Henry Timms, of a new book, New Power, How Power Works in Our Hyperconnected World and How to Make It Work for You. Fascinating stuff. Jeremy, thanks a lot for taking some time. I appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about how color works and why. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, we talked about the movement to rename the Paseo Boulevard after Martin Luther King Jr. Listen to that and all of our previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, the powerful personalities and dynamic internal politics that shape the decisions handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. That's tomorrow on Up to Date. And don't forget to join us tonight for Reaction or Riot, Understanding Kansas City in 1968. It'll be a conversation about our city in the wake of King's death 50 years ago today. You can find out more, get more information, and RSVP. Just go online at kcur.org/MLK. Well, cheerful yellow, dull gray, fiery red, we often describe colors by the mood or emotion they evoke because that's exactly what they can do. Besides color, besides mood, color also plays a practical role in our everyday lives, making the places we live and work in safer and more functional. The overall result can be a happier and healthier you. How color works and how we can use it when designing spaces is a specialty of Catherine Gruby, owner of Functional Color Solutions. She's also an associate professor of interior design at Johnson County Community College, where she joins me from this morning via Skype. Catherine, thanks for taking some time.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
How do you define color?
Color. Well, color is such a wonderful thing, something that I feel we really take for granted. But understanding how it works is quite a blessing for us. If you think about color being sunlight, white sunlight, and sunlight being energy, within that pure white sunlight, we have our rainbow colors, our seven wavelengths of light through our Roy G. Biv. And when that light bends, that's when we see the different colors. But color comes down in the form of light, and it's an energy. So if you think of Newton's first law of thermodynamics, it will go through, it doesn't stop. The color comes down and it reflects off. So when it reflects off, that's the color that we see out of that rainbow. So if you have your green grass, all the colors of Roy G. Biv are going in the grass, and then it reflects off and we see that green. But that wavelength of green is still moving. It still has energy and actually can absorb into our skin and change the way our mind and body react to it.
Huh. So it's all about light, ultimately. Do I have that right? And what kind of light and how it plays on color?
So color is light. If we only had one wavelength of light in our sunlight, we would only have one set of colors. So we have those seven wavelengths of light. So color is ultimately the same thing as light. If we had no light, we would have darkness and no color. So color is light, and the light is also energy. So if that makes sense, the wavelengths of the color are in the sunlight, and when they reflect, they're also energy that actually make us react.
Is the number of color combinations ultimately infinite?
Well, the human eye can see about 16 million different color combinations.
So those 16 million.
16 million, which is pretty phenomenal, and they all come from those seven colors of the rainbow, the Roy G. Biv, and then mixed with themselves or different combinations, or with black or white. Those the 16 million we can see, but there are some animals that can see over 340 million different colors.
Oh my God,
that's how in tune they are. So
when it comes to picking a color to paint my office, this is why I struggle, because we see so many different colors, right?
Yeah, and there's a lot to do with it being. It depends what kind of function you're trying to have in your office. If you're trying to have a calming area, if you're trying to do stimulating, or trying to, you know, counter lack of sunlight that you have, it just depends what you're trying to accomplish. But each color of the rainbow gives off a different type of wavelength that affects the body differently. So you can have warm colors, which are your red, orange, and yellows, and those are stimulating. And the cooler colors, which are green, blue, indigo, and violet, those are more calming. So each one has a specific way it affects the body. It's just trying to figure out how we respond.
Are there colors that humans are universally drawn to here?
Well, that's a great question, because color is a universal language. So it doesn't. We all have blue skies all over the world. We all have a reflection of the sky into the water, which gives us the wonderful tones of blue in the water, sunshine, etc. So it doesn't matter where we are. We all understand that, you know, red is what red represents. Culturally, it can be different things, but we're organic. So human beings are living and breathing. We are born and we grow and we develop. And we have to have water, and we have to have sunlight to maintain a sensory variety. So if you put yourself back in the nature of what is around us, that's how we, you know, we see a cool blue sky. It's soothing to us. You know, sunshine is warm, and we can feel the energy on our face and different aspects. So no matter where you are in the world, each color is made up of just our foundation of being organic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. Catherine Gruby is my guest. She's a professor out at Johnson County Community College and owner of Functional Color Solutions. You know, you've talked about how color has the power to simultaneously unite the five senses. How does it do that?
Okay, so color goes back all the way back to Aristotle, okay, back in 220 BC, where color and sound were actually put together. But if you think about color, so if I was to blindfold you and to put a strawberry under your nose, it's how we've learned. It's either innate in our bodies and our DNA of what we've learned. You know, red means stop, green means go. Mm-hmm. Or if it's cultural, like in Asian countries, red is very powerful and a positive. In some other countries in the world, it would be seen negatively. So color, if you think about it, like a red fire truck is a very loud color. Mm-hmm. It's very loud. It's evasive. If you think of pastels for a nursery or something that are light blues and light mints, they're
soft and gentle. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So color also has temperature. That we were saying, the warm colors. If you see a cool blue sky, it feels cool versus a fiery red sunset, which gives off the sensation of heat. Taste, we associate color with taste. So sours are associated with greens and yellows. Mm-hmm. So there's your lemons, limes. We associate sweets with pinks and reds. And if you think about like blue foods, it's really, we correlate that being moldy or unappetizing. So besides a blueberry, you know, if you really think about it, it's hard to name one color of another type of food that's blue that we would enjoy to eat. So it's kind of a turnoff.
You actually say in the introduction here, Catherine, that color can make a place feel safer. How does it do that?
Okay, so if you're in, let's take an academic setting for one, so something that's intimidating, or a medical or healthcare, you know, that people fear the dentist more than cancer. I can kind of relate, but having something in the environment, because when you color how it works, if you remember that it's energy and it's reflecting off the walls for an interior space, that energy goes in our skin and it changes our makeup and our psychologically and physiologically. So having something that's calming or soothing, our body reacts within 5 to 15 minutes of a space based on what colors around us. So if we have blues that are soothing colors, or even browns that give a sense of warmth or comfort and depth, versus, you know, the gray or white, which can appear very cold or very sterile, very institutional.
Mm-hmm.
Color just welcomes us to the day. So if you think today we finally have some wonderful blue skies and some sunshine, it appears that it's a lot warmer outside if you look out the window from what it is actually, especially for April. But the last few days we've had these gray, depressing days, and, you know, we don't respond well to the gray. It makes us sad.
Right.
So
right.
Heavy color and can actually welcome you and make you feel safe, secure, and that you're meant to be there, that you want to be there. Your body feels comfortable and not controlling anxiety or irritating.
So there's a lot more to consider when you go ahead and decide to paint a room or an office than just what color do I like. There are other things to seriously consider here.
Absolutely. It all depends on your elements and principles of design that make up good design. So depending on how color reflects in different types of textures or different types of patterns or architectural elements, being able to say, to give the right tones. Color all have, you know, different tones. You have warm tones, you have cool tones, and getting a specific blend that works well together. So it's not just preference of, oh, I like this robin's egg blue crayon color, and then I'm going to mix it with this indigo blue, because if the wrong tones or the wrong amounts, then they'll give a negative effect.
Hmm.
It kind of backfires. So you really need somebody who's trained to understand how it works to give a good design solution.
Catherine Gruby is my desk. We're talking about the power of color. If you want to join our conversation and get some expert advice on how to paint your next room or office, 816-235-2888 is the number, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So why do so many offices end up using, you know, these boring neutral colors?
Well, it's safe, and color is really seen as a preference. So there's a lot of the path of least resistance for the designers or architects,
mm-hmm.
Just to be honest. And there's a tradition with that, but people are going to want to paint their office whatever color that they like. And what I'm trying to do is bring awareness of how color actually influences our health and well-being, and it's not just a preference of what we like aesthetically. So green and the grays and the whites and the neutrals, they go with anything, they're safe, and there's not a lot of thought that has to go into it.
But it's pretty easy to go overboard with energizing colors if you want to juice up your office a little bit.
And that's a designer that you see an error a lot in design with using these real high saturated colors.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're too saturated and then you add pattern to it, or you add, you know, different, too much shape, our body it's like overstimulation, and it gives a negative effect. So it's not what we think. We have to understand that that's such a strong, powerful color that our bodies can't absorb that and it be positive. We have to have a balance. We're organic. And we need softer tones or textures that, if you can put it all back to nature, where things are out in the amounts, versus putting lime green on the wall with bright orange. And yeah, it looks great on a magazine cover, but try living in it.
Yeah. So even if I'm not conscious of the color of my workspace, your point is it's still going to wind up affecting me.
It absolutely does. You don't even have to, if you could be visually impaired, because the color is energy and it absorbs in our skin. It also absorbs in our eyes and we see it, but whether we were blind or visually impaired, that energy is still reflecting off and it absorbs in our skin. So if we have a select color of blue, blue actually suppresses our appetite. It calms us. It lowers our respiration rate. It lowers our blood pressure versus something that's yellow that actually increases our stimulation. And yellow has been known to promote memory and generate, it energizes the skin. So it's used in a lot of gyms or workout areas to get a better workout.
Right.
It's just using it strategically. Yeah. So you don't need to be able to see it. Yes, to be able to reap the rewards of it.
So Joe tweeted us this question, Catherine. Is color subjective? What is an invigorating and exciting green to one person might be overwhelming and too bright to somebody else? Any psychology behind how color affects different people?
Okay, the psychology goes all the way back to 350 years to the 1600s of testing and case studies. So it's a preference. It's just getting the right, you have something called light reflectance value and getting that depending on whatever the task is. So it's critical to understand what the function of the space is and how to approach that. So somebody may not like a different type of green over somebody else being subjective, but that's a preference in aesthetic. But if you're trying to promote the function, the certain shade or tone of green in the right light reflectance and the right strength, you have something called chroma in color, which is the intensity or brightness, can still affect in a positive way. It just may not be a favorite preference. So being a good designer, you have to meet the aesthetic in with the function and say these are the options and work the best with the client's needs and wants.
So then ultimately then, Catherine, what does our choice of color say about us?
Well, each color has, you know, properties of being strong or stimulating or calming. So like blue is a global color of trust. It is used in more banking institutions in the world than any other color in their logo. It is the most color accepted among males, and it is the most abundant in nature. If you think about the sky and the reflections on water, so we have, that's the color that we see the most or most available. Yellow is it all depends on what product you're putting it on to. If it's an interior space, you know, yellow is a cheerful, it can be, but if it's overused or misused, it can be the harshest on the body because it's the most luminous color.
That's interesting.
So I see a lot of people put taxicab yellow or canary yellow on their walls because they appreciate the small paint sample swatch. But when you get it in that amount of mass on your walls, it actually is overstimulating. It's too powerful for the body to absorb.
We had an email here, Catherine, who wanted to know from Anne, who wants to know if you give workshops and where you give them, because probably a lot of us, like Anne, need help with color selection.
I actually do give workshops, and I do private training for employee training or any type of design for business too. So they can go to my website at functionalcolorsolutions.com.
Okay.
And check out what are available there. And they can contact me through the website at functionalcolor@yahoo.com. And we can set up a consultation to see what they need or set up some workshops with a group. So even if they had a group of 10 or 12 people that were interested, we could do it privately. So
the website again, functionalcolorsolutions.com.
You got it.
Okay. That's Catherine Gruby. She's owner of Functional Color Solutions and associate professor of interior design at Johnson County Community College. Catherine, thanks for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Steve. I appreciate your interest.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And tonight, join Up to Date at the UMKC Miller Nichols Library as we look at Kansas City's response to the assassination of Martin Luther King 50 years ago. You can RSVP at kcur.org/MLK. I hope to see you there. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
Thank you.